Hi, this is Matthew Ross. Welcome back to the next episode of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Today, with Michael Pontone. I hear you in the background. How you doing there, Mike?
I'm yelling at clouds. I hate the world. I hate you and everything in it.
Well,
and gaseous anomalies.
Well, that's probably because you probably ate too many beans. Today
I'm 38 going on 890. I'm angry and I don't know what to do about these emotions.
Well, let's go talk about Where No Man Has Gone Before, Star Trek.
Thank God for Star Trek. I would have murdered my wife and dog a long time ago if it worked for Star Trek, let me tell you.
You got a lot of anger in you, I hear, there.
No. Having a good time.
But it's
I'm happy to hear your voice.
Happy to hear you. It seems like I just saw you on, I don't know, Wednesday. This was over here. This is the third episode of the first season of the original series, but it is actually the pilot of the original series. And it was shown third because the executives wanted to have something more action-y in the first episode, and they chose the man trap with the salt sucker. So what's your initial impressions of what we just saw here, knowing that this was actually the initial pilot, or rather the second pilot, which we'll come to later? But what do you think about this episode of Where No Man Has Gone Before?
Well, I was watching this, and after, again, just as a quick background, Michael Pontone here, co-host to head host Matt Ross, mostly newbie to the original series, big fan of the movies, TNG, DS9 is my baby, and, middling fan to everything else. Now, so far, I have been introduced to the Mad Trap and Charlie X, thought they were pretty neat, and then I saw this guy, and right off the bat, I'm like, there's some weird things going on here. I don't know why. Okay, let's go through it as we usually do. We open up. Spock has a pound of green makeup on him.
Don't forget his eyebrows and that super cool turtleneck sweater type of thing. That's pretty cool.
He's wearing command gold.
Yes.
Gone is the blue. He's working the helm. Uhura's nowhere to be found. And little background actors of George Takei and James Doohan, merely extras. I don't even think, does Sulu have a line in this?
Well, actually he does, he's actually the XO. What you can't really tell is that Kirk and Spock's shirts are actually green. Everyone else's are yellows, it's just so they stand out, but the way the color comes in through the color of the show, everything looks gold. And it's a proof of concept to try and show that they could come up with this idea. As I'm sure a lot of people know from listening to just every other Star Trek podcast on the planet, that the initial concept was something called The Cage, which starred Jeffrey Hunter. And that didn't sell, but for the NBC executives who were watching it, said, you know what, I like the concept, do another one. And one of the rare instances of a second pilot. And here we are with Where No Man Has Gone Before, now starring William Shatner. Also, it stars Gary Lockwood, who later you could see in the movie 2001, Frank Poole. And Sally Kellerman, who is also known as Hot Lips Houlihan from MASH. So it's a different cast overall. Also, the color schemes are different. There's no bright red except on some railing, but everything is kind of a gray, dull, bland, blue, goldish, and like I said, you wouldn't know it, but green shirt look and everything. And everything is very, very muted. You do have those other characters you pointed out. Yes, exactly. You have the other characters. You have George Takei is mathematics. You have a Dr. Piper, who is Mark Piper, who's the chief medical officer. Sally Kellerman, the guest star, if you will, is Dr. Daner. And you have Scotty, who seems to be a secondary engineer to Lieutenant Kelso. And you also have another chairperson on the bridge, a Mr. Alden, who goes around seeming to fix everything. So you have actually a diverse cast, but again, you have a whole bunch of professionals doing their job. I mean, it's odd that this was chosen to be the third episode. I don't know if they would not have succeeded this was shown first. You know, that impression of where they're on a bridge, they have a ship, they have crew, everyone's doing their job. That was kind of interesting, to, at least to me.
There are so many different things going on here. One, it just solidified as you were talking about this. This episode was shot. It was designed as if it was going to be a black and white shot show, just like The Cage.
Right.
It was black and white, right?
Well, it was both black and white and color. So you don't actually know that until the 1980 something or other when they actually released it. But it does look like it, if it was black and white, the imperfections would have been, you would have missed certain things. But I still found it believable in the sense that I still felt like you were on some sort of naval ship, a spaceship of some sort. There's a very Earth-centric feel to it. They keep mentioning the Earth all the way through. And in fact, that's also the first instance of things you find is that they discover that the starship of Venture Valiant, excuse me, lost its way and somehow was destroyed. They find their marker buoy or of its records of what's going on, and they think it was destroyed. In fact, they even say it was destroyed, yet they question it later. But they're at the edge of the galaxy, and they're about to leave. And that's where we...
Yeah, I mean, let me just say, they're all over the place in this episode, right? Okay, so let's take it from the top. Let me look at my notes here. Briefing lounge has the multi-level chessboard.
Yes. It's
astonishing that this little thing that I thought was a TNG invention has been around from apparently its inception.
Uh-huh.
They're in the briefing lounge, quote unquote, which is obviously like a 10 forward stand-in, and they're playing chess, they're having a drink, and they've got the view screen there, which, come to think of it, I've never seen a view screen in Star Trek outside of the bridge. It's very strange.
Well, you'll see that there are view screens all over the place. They sometimes come in and go away, depending on what the script calls for. But it's interesting they are watching that. Why don't they just have a window? They're excited because they're heading towards the edge of known space or the edge of the galaxy. Yeah. And that's when they...
By the way, that's also, like, talking about inconsistencies, and obviously they sloughed off, and it's amazing because, you know, you and I love Star Trek, and we can see how it started mushy, right?
Yeah,
this thing that with tremendously tight continuity has become so firm.
Well, yeah, they didn't have a real idea yet of everything that was going to come together, but they actually did give you enough of a basis so you had an idea that there was something going on, that as in, like, there's an organization that they're doing something out there, exploring, looking for something, and that it's
sure,
a big deal.
Like when they say edge of galaxy, I mean, like, what have we got here? The geography of the galaxy becomes so important later on Star Trek, of like, you know, who's in the alpha, who's in the beta, you know, there's the gamma quadrant on DS9, there's the delta quadrant, the delta quadrant on DS9,
well,
the gamma quadrant in Voyager.
Well, you're jumping way ahead. This is a very, very early episode of a TV show that just, you know, came out of Gene Roddenberry's mind, and it's amazing to see how from this nascent beginning of whatever it is, becomes this huge franchise with over 850 episodes and 12 movies, 14 movies. It's still going. It's amazing to think that from these humble beginnings, so to speak, you had pointed out, because we watched it before seeing this, that it had a very Twilight Zone feel. I think that's all the way through the episode, between the pacing, the music, the eeriness, which we get to as we approach the pink galaxy edge barrier, which is also something that is never really raised ever again, except maybe in Star Trek V, except it's not pink. It's also a weird concept that there's some weird pink radiation thing. But even...
This episode is all over the place. I mean, what is the edge of the galaxy? There's a barrier. Also, what was that probe?
Well, the Valiant was out there exploring, just like the Enterprises at this time, and then they discovered the marker buoy saying something bad happened, and they discovered that when they hit the bubblegum wall, as I always like to think about it, they discovered that it killed a whole bunch of crew members, 7 of them, and then they realized one of them came back to life, and then they began to frequently, they were desperate to find information on ESP, and they're looking up records. There's that little bit of kind of like snark between Kirk and Dr. Dane. They're like, what do you know about ESP? Oh, I'm really good at it, or I have a high rating. I didn't ask you what you thought about it. I'm asking, you know, what it is that you know about it as a scientist. There's something that's interesting. They're talking about ESP, which is also a bizarre concept for something, for a show that's grounded in science. ESP comes up quite a lot, although some people...
Well, I mean, go on.
No, I was going to say most people would say that, you know, some people think that they have ESP or they actually believe that they're seers and so forth, but it's never really been proven on anything in our modern age. And it's an interesting concept here that it's being raised here in 1966, or actually beforehand, before this is even on there, as an interesting concept. But it's more of a fantasy concept, I would argue, in a lot of ways, with mind reading and so forth. But then it becomes majorly important all the way through the rest of Star Trek.
Right, except that for the most part, it is fascinating to see that you know, human beings are not... At no point in Star Trek history are there, you know, psychic humans. You get psychic Betazoids. You get, obviously, Vulcans who could do the tactile, you know, mild telepathy of the mind meld. But, you know, it's interesting that they were trying to, you know, when you're writing sci-fi, you're omnipotent, as my idol Rich Evans has commented.
No, I was just going to say that. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You were saying.
Well, just that it is always interesting when you go with one sci-fi concept, you do another. Like, I actually really like that in the movie Looper. Did you ever see Looper?
You know what? That's one of the ones I have yet to see. I know it stars Bruce Willis, I believe it is, right?
Yeah. I like it quite a bit. It's got an absolutely bone-chilling scene in it, which I'm not going to describe, but made the hair raise on, you know, I'm a big horror fan. And when people ask me, what's a horror movie scene that frightens you? I'm like, no, Looper. The scene from Looper where this guy is getting cut up in the past and his body starts disappearing.
That sounds cool.
In the future. Yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Maybe we'll watch that together.
No, they see as a spinoff show, yes, a special holiday production of Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. But so Looper, right? It's it goes one concept of we're in a world with time travel. But then, in good writing form, they say also some people have telekinesis, mild telekinesis. I'm like, yeah, of course. If the audience is willing to suspend their disbelief as to time travel, why wouldn't they suspend their disbelief to telekinesis? And in here, if we're in the future and we're traveling faster than the speed of light and there are aliens, why would it be a bizarre concept to say humans have started to develop ESP? Well, you know, that being said, they abandoned it for the rest of the series.
Well, I mean, also, I think that something, because it's almost, I'm going to jump ahead of scene, because after they hit the barrier, a couple of people, you know, die, but two people are guest stars, get zapped, and one of them wakes up with silver eyes, which I want to mention in a second. But there's a line that they're talking about what's happened to the people affected, and the doctor says, we're just talking about a superior human being. Why not embrace the change of the homo superior, is what she's advocating, which is basically pro-eugenics, which is something that the world has just been pulling out. She sure is. She's saying, like, we need to... What if this was a great thing for humanity coming up ahead? You want to... we're talking about a homo superior. She's talking about how Gary Mitchell exhibits superior abilities to us normies. And I think that's a little, it's a pretty wild concept considering that the world's just recovering from World War II and Korea War, but mainly World War II, the fear of the, I think, of a German Übermensch and is still lurking in the background. You know, Gene Roddenberry himself was a World War II veteran, so I wouldn't be surprised if that somehow leaked in there. It was an interesting, to me, it was an interesting nod to some sort of eugenics, which hasn't even come as a word yet in this series, and you've got a ways to get into that.
I see it less as eugenics and just like, you know, with the advent of the, remember, all this is happening in the atomic age, right?
Yes.
And when you start to see atomic age stuff, that's when you know, there the concept of, well, again, we underestimate how crazy it was to have the atomic bomb, right? Something that was purely theoretical, that there is such a thing as atomic energy, and then releasing it, not only releasing it to a mild chemical reaction, but a tremendous chemical reaction. It's the equivalent of if we discovered, like, Tony Stark's repulsor beams or anti-gravitons or something in the modern age. It's like, wow, stuff that was purely science fiction is like fact. So the atomic age stuff, you see that all over the place. If anything, you know, Homo Superior, that's X-Men.
They do hit a giant pink piece of bubblegum and people die. And both Dr. Daner and Gary Mitchell, who's just the pilot, Mr. Spock is actually the XO, he gets zapped and he wakes up and his eyes turn silver. Long-time Star Trek fans know those were painted silver contact lenses. And the actors hated wearing them. In fact, so
they must have been completely blind.
Well, almost. They actually had to look down, like raising their heads up and look down. So all the scenes that they're in, they all look like they couldn't see because they were like looking through the very bottoms of the lenses. But that they decided to not redo it because they looked like they were arrogant, self-assured assholes, which actually fits the characters that Gary Mitchell turns into. That one of the other early things that's funny is they're approaching the bubblegum. I think it's hilarious, at least to me, that for some reason, Gary Mitchell grabs the arm of the Yeoman Smith standing behind him through the entire sequence of thinking, maybe you could control your position better if you use, I don't know, both hands and let go of the young lady who's, I guess, terrified standing behind him. That's just something silly that stands out. Did you notice that at all?
I did not, actually. It was not apparent. I watched the episode twice, once on my own and once with you just now. And that went over my head.
Wait, as they go through the storm, or actually when they come out, then they look at Gary, and he's able to, like, begin to manipulate things. The ship, he's manipulating the medical stuff. He's reading up Spinoza, which surprises Kirk, who must have been a TA at whatever school there was, at the unnamed Starfleet Academy. He was like a book with legs, as Gary calls him. And because remember, in Kirk's class, you either, was it think or sink? And then there's something that's raised later in later Star Trek is that Gary Mitchell says he aimed a blonde lab technician to Kirk to distract him. Some people have speculated that is Carol Marcus. Kirk is actually Carol Marcus is his wife, or not wife, or his baby mama in Star Trek II, but she's blonde. Kirk is not as much of a Lothario as the modern culture likes to depict, thanks to the J.J. Stories and also for the green slave women. Oh, Kirk has all those things, but it's just like calling Mr. Spock Dr. Spock. It's just wrong. Doc, the actual one who's like the hound dog is actually Gary Mitchell.
That's
the yeoman, the doctor, Dr. Daner, Sally Kellerman says, like, I hear that's your law, that's your department, your line included, and he likens her to a walking freezer unit to Lieutenant Kelso, who's sitting next to him on the bridge. Later, when he's down in sick bay, and he's reading up on, like, he's read half the ship's library in half a day. He actually draws Dr. Daner close to him, and for some reason, She begins to really appreciate him, and he's questioning her, haven't you been affected like I? Like he knows something, or affected like me. And she has yet to exhibit any of the changes that Gary has. And then that's where Lieutenant Kelso comes on in, and further psychic powers are exhibited, where Mitchell says to Kelso, hey, you better check the engines again, you dummy, because you forgot something. And he turns out he was right. And that leads to a whole new level. I'm right. Well, you have to also take props to the cinematography in this because that is actually something pretty amazing. Like,
Whoa. Wait a second. That's the Delta Vega where Kirk meets Spock in Star Trek 2009?
sorry, for some reason it cut out. I was just saying that that Delta Vega was a really nice rough cup area over here. You get the real impression that that this is an actual place, that it looks real, it feels w real in some ways. I mean, you know, you're watching a TV show, but it was really interesting
Let me just say
to
too,
watch.
we skipped ahead a little bit. Interesting things going on here. I like Mitchell. Gary Mitchell, the actor, of course, is absolutely amazing. He's kind of taking it way more seriously and chewing scenery, but chewing scenery in a good way, than his fellow compadres there. He's really, really shooting for it. And I was like, man, this guy's a good actor. And I looked him up, and of course, lo and behold, Frank Poole, 2001, A Space Odyssey. Which is, I guess that
Yeah, that
Kubrick was like, wow, this guy's all right. Wouldn't that have been like the same year?
let's see, I don't remember when 2001 A Space Odyssey came out. I'm sure you
Oh
could
God.
Google it real fast right now, but
Well, because I remember that it was before the moon landing, which is insane for how good it looks and how accurate it was.
that's actually one of my favorite movies, 2001, even though I don't know the year. It's from 1968, so this predates it by 2 years. That was a great movie, but Gary Lockwood is an excellent actor. He is in other things and television shows through the years. So is Sally Kellerman. But you know these,
Of
you
course.
know, I mean, to be honest, I didn't think William Shatner did a terrible job here. Neither did
No, he's
Nimoy.
great.
You know, they do their time on Mission Impossible, the Desilu run. They're like in everything there. It's interesting to see them trying to feel out what their roles are and what actually happens here. And again, the sets from the ship to the planet, it all looks believable. It's nothing crazy. You don't have an elevator that could take up 5 football fields like you do later in Discovery, or just like the odd angled, brightly lit everything. You get the impression of a cramped, almost a submarine-like style of a ship going through stuff. What did you think of when they were down on the planet? What were your thoughts now when they were down there?
I like that they were obviously doing some kind of rule building where this is not a Q, this is not Charlie X. He's a man. He's just a man who's wielding tremendous power. You know, he can be distracted. He can be sucker punched. He's not omnipotent. He's just rolling around with like a bazooka. After that, it was good. Honestly, Matt, the episode goes pretty fugazi pretty quickly. Suddenly, Sally Kellerman gets Hot Lips, gets the power. It was just going slower than it was for him. Didn't really get that one. And then Kirk is going on an away mission by himself with a gigantic space bazooka.
It's a phaser rifle, the one and only time it appears in the original series. Cool prop, though.
Like where it is a cool prop, and phaser rifles obviously come back, you know, in spades in later series, especially DS9. But like, why is the captain going off on essentially an away mission slash assassination mission by himself?
Because he is the hero, and he's responsible for 428 lives, or 428 lives. So
So he, by himself, with a phaser rifle, is going to go try to kill two mutants.
Well, he actually is out to kill one mutant specifically, which is his best friend. So I think the character is feeling like he owes him at least that much as a sign of respect to say, like, listen, I have to make this choice. No one else can. Spock wants to kill him right away. No questions asked, but Kirk actually wrestles with the image. He doesn't want to leave him on the planet. He even makes note that the ore ships come once every 20 years. He, you know, thinks like he's concerned that this is a friend who took a poison dart from some sort of rat thing on another planet, which even Mitchell raises later. But he also, I think the character realizes, is that with absolute power comes absolute, you know, corruption in this regard. He sees his former friend and confidant turn into this megalomaniac killer person who admitted that he'd squash everyone like bugs and that he didn't want to come to Delta Vega because he wasn't sure how he could use the planet for his needs. So I think Kirk is trying to buy time for the ship to get out of there. He says, if you don't hear from me in 12 hours, get the heck out of here, which is, it seems like a lot of time, you know? What if he screws up? I think, you know, everyone would be all Gary Mitchell'd. But you also have to wonder about how long Gary Mitchell would have survived anyway. At the beginning, you know, he just has silver eyes. By the time we get up to the end, he's got lots of gray hair suddenly. That was something I always noticed, that his temples turn gray. I guess it's to show being distinguished in some way, but it also seems a little bit bizarre that he seems to age rapidly. So that's just something I noticed on the, it's a little touch, like on the side of his side of his temples start turning really silver. So is that him aging, or is that him getting more super cool psychic power stuff? It's kind of interesting to think of it in that way. And this is, by the way, the third psychic power type of thing, if you think about it, in a row, out of all this, out of the three we've seen. In the Man Trap, the alien had psychic powers. Charlie X has as great as, if not equal to, Gary Mitchell's psychic powers. And now we have the ultimate in psychic powers right here.
Yeah, again, we're three for three here.
Yep.
That being said, you know, that leads me to my central problem with this episode. We're going to skip essentially to the end, because honestly, everything gets wrapped up pretty quickly. Confrontation, lots of talking, and then rock slide, death, and, you know, go back to the bridge, making a log.
And don't forget the James R. Kirk headstone, because we don't have a T yet, which we don't get until years later, but go ahead.
I do dig the headstone. I thought that was a cool image. And again, that was like an image right out of Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Like, just, oh, here's a headstone for you. This is a thing which is now, like, here's something that you can talk about little details. Oh, Spock wearing the wrong tunic, or, you know, the character's missing. Here's something that I think that the Trek Bible in the future does not mess around with. There's no explanation. This is real fugazi. They go to the edge of space. Two people get influenced by something. They turn omnipotent. They die. There's no revelation. And this is the thing that I love about Star Trek writing, is when there's a mystery, it's usually solved.
And then you'll never hear from them.
The salt monster.
Right.
The salt monster is solved. You know, Barclay's nth degree, when he becomes a super genius, another omnipotent-esque character, is solved. Why is this happening? Clues, it's solved. It's good writing. The question really becomes, does Gene Roddenberry know? Did he know why this was happening?
Well, he actually didn't. I think he just wanted to have an adventure, wanted to make a buck. That's my, but that's true for most writers out there anyway. I question also, like, did he know what this would lead into? And also, and we'll never talk about this ever again, because it,
no,
you know,
obviously, go
no, on. No, it's just because they never raise this, they never get back to where it is, but it's actually not written by Gene Roddenberry. It's written by Samuel Peoples, who wrote this. That's the actual person. He's a science fiction enthusiast. And he wrote for TV and so forth. And he worked for Roddenberry. But I see Roddenberry adapting this for his characters because he needs something to do. And he has an idea of the big picture, not the small little bits that come together. But I could see Roddenberry saying like, "Ooh, that sounds cool." Of course, probably with him, he'd want more women in it because that's just the reputation of Gene Roddenberry. But this was interesting as an interesting ride. But if
Yeah, it's a very unsexy episode, as you point out. You don't have Uhura popping around with her midriff or her
But you
miniskirt.
do have Mr. Alden, so there we do have a diverse crew between him and
We do have a diverse group in Sulu,
right. We
yeah.
do have we have a
By the
Scottish
way,
guy, yeah.
the old doctor with the very lumpy body underneath the blue tunic, is he was he the proto McCoy? Was he supposed to be the doctor of the ship?
Yes, he was supposed to be the doctor of ship. There's actually three doctors in these early stages. In the cage, it's Dr. Piper. Here, it's no, I'm sorry, it was Dr. Boyce in the cage. Here, it's Dr. Piper, and then they settle on Dr. McCoy. All three of those actors did work in the Western TV shows, so they were riding the circuit, and they settled on DeForest Kelly. What's interesting, by the way, about
Yeah.
Dr. Piper in this episode, he does come up later in Battlestar Galactica, the 1970s version, as a another commander in there, still looking lumpy, but that's he was he just wanted to do westerns, is my understanding, or was not a fit for this, so they went back to offering it to D. Kelly. But again,
And
this is just a proof of an idea. I'm so, what about,
Mitchell.
yeah?
Hold on. Does Mitchell appear in any of the prequel stuff? I
Nope.
mean, is he bopping around strange worlds anywhere? Is he a
No,
hero?
they haven't hit that pond yet. They've done a lot of things. They have their more Jim Carrey-esque, as he's referred to, Jim Kirk. Strange New Worlds is doesn't really fit what this is. Again, but this just like the Cage, they're both pilots, so they're always going to be rough. I just want to mention one other thing. Right before Star Trek: The Next Generation came out, Majel Barrett Roddenberry, whom I actually worked for at a convention at the Omni Park Central Hotel in 1985-ish, said something like, "Well, we're all going to come up with an idea." This was to me generally, but to the audience, she goes, "Do you want it to be where no man has gone before, which is what this is, or where no one has gone before?" And the audience picked where no one has gone before. I'd like to think that audience members picked the new tagline for the next gen. But
Sure.
she also made fun of next gen uniforms, saying everyone looks like they're standing on an angle. And she was an interesting person to work for at the Lincoln Enterprises table for a while, at least. I had a good time. But that's a story for another time. But that was just interesting that they reused this title for two things. One, by rechanging the name of an episode to making it where no one, and also the next gen tagline is no for no from no man to no one, which is actually later
Of
heard
course.
in Star Trek VI to show that
Undiscovered
everyone, yep,
country.
where they are growing up a little bit. But by the way, Mike, I also heard from our fan that they'd like us to have a rating
One fan, we
system.
love you.
Yes, we love you, one fan, or several fans out there. There are dozens, I hear. So, if you had to give this a scale of a 1 to 10, our very scientific made-up 1 to 10 scale, what would you give it? And tell me why.
Tell you right now. Okay, so sloppy writing will bring it at a for Star Trek writing the usual level at a 3 out of 10. However, excellent acting brings it up to an 8 out of 10. So I'm going to split the difference and I'm going to call this a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, interesting.
And compared to Charlie X, which I give 7, and Salt Monster Mantrap a 7 as well.
That's it. I'm going to give this one a 7 out of 10, and because to me it like opened up the idea of the adventure. Maybe I'm looking at it for nostalgia with fuzzy eyes and so forth, and marveling at the pretty makeup that everyone's wearing, including William Shatner. But I enjoyed the adventure of going someplace. I even l enjoyed the fact that the computer showed courier typewritten text on the screens. But I did like. I just like the adventure, the story, the idea, and it was not just shooting everyone, although at the end it does turn into a shooting Fest. Charlie X for me is an example. I think I would also give a 7, if not an 8. It's one of my more favorite one. And the Mantrap, you know, for me it was always hard to get into. I would give it a 6 to 7. That's what I would put it in for our ratings anyway. But that's where it is. Anything else you want to talk about on this episode, Mike, or?
Yes, in fact, I was wondering if we could maybe start little segments, quick little segments here.
Sure.
A WTF moment of each episode, which there's always going to be.
Always.
WTF moment of this one for me was, in a good way, it was a pretty cool image. I don't know if you can, if you remember this, for 1 second when the bubblegum barrier is like messing up the ship and everyone, all the consoles are exploding. There's like a 1 second insert of a pretty psychedelic thing of a person getting shocked. You know, it's like a black outline with electricity around it.
Yeah, that's both Gary Mitchell and Dr. Daner get that. Yeah, I like that.
It was cool. It was like, oh man, like I said, a little bit scary. Like, all right, you know what? You could have just had someone jumping up, but they went through and they were like, they went through the episode and was like, okay, we need a 1 second insert here. And it was pretty cool. I also have another segment
Sure,
here.
go ahead.
Well, a little bit. Echoes of Future Trek, right? What do we see in this little tiny pilot episode that you'll see throughout the rest? You get the red alert, which is the exact same goddamn sound, which I was astonished at.
I love that sound.
I love it too, but I'm just like, whoa, this red alert has been used in every Star Trek for the next 60 years. Amazing. What else we got? We got obviously a multi-level chessboard,
Well, they also have
diverse
the
cast.
phasers, you know, the phasers that Spock is walking with is actually used in the Man Trap. They reused everything, and later you'll see it's used in the cage. It shows that there's a sort of continuity. One of the nice touches that I notice is that this is if you look carefully where Kirk is sitting down, you'll see that each one of their command badges actually is detailed enough that you could see that everyone has a different division. Kirk and Spock and Gary Mitchell have stars. The doctors have those circles for the medical. The yeoman has like a weird swirl, which means general services or operations. It's actually pretty cool that for, you know, a pilot, you're trying to throw everything at the screen to make it stick. But here they had a lot of stuff trying to jam in there, and they're trying to make a complete world, and you feel like you're there. It's not like someone's wearing a basketball uniform, that's blue and
You're right.
gold. You know, you get to feel that this is an actual service or something. And in some ways, I actually am a little bit sad that they went to miniskirts for the women. I feel like that everyone was wearing pants. It kind of made more sense. Pants in space.
Hey, relax, man. We're trying to have a good time here,
Yeah, I
okay?
got you.
Sixties.
I got you. You gotta wear your go-go boots.
Also, Echoes of Future Trek, I really dug already. First freaking episode. I'm amazed. Difference between impulse power and warp.
Yes.
And that's something that is not only referenced for the next 60 years, it becomes a recurring plot element. You know, once or twice people have lost their warp drive and are limping along at impulse and are like, well, this would take 5 minutes, now it's going to take 3 years.
Yes.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's an interesting concept of the two different types of engine types. I think that's makes it neat to look at. Again, it makes it feel real in as much as it can. Even like the little tiny things, like when they're getting up to speed, they don't like suddenly, like in, let's say, Star Wars, where you're suddenly, let's go to hyperspace and bam, you're over somewhere else. You've got the idea that these are plotting vessels, like in real life. Ships take their time to get up to speed to do something. Even though there's no friction in space, I don't believe that ships just suddenly are, well, none of our ships, at least in today's science, can go, suddenly we're 20,000 miles an hour. Now they've used planets to slingshot themselves around for the speed.
Right.
You could see the
They're
ship.
worried about getting stuck in Delta Vega's
Right,
orbit.
and they're actually, when they do go warp, go to space warp to get to the. To that barrier, you can see the ship doesn't immediately jump into it. It slowly builds up to get to speed. It's interesting. So,
well, I mean, Star Wars is not science fiction, in my opinion.
No, it's science fantasy. It is. It is. It's sci fantasy. I know one of our listeners will hate the fact that I call it that, Lawrence. Sorry, but it's called.
Yeah, Larry, Lawrence. We've had this debate on the trains of the Bronx before. I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's sci fantasy. It's, you know, you got space wizards with laser swords. But anyway, overall, I thought that was an enjoyable episode.
Another bit.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good riddance. Something that exists that appeared in this episode, which I'm glad did not reappear. A tiny little galaxy where you could just go to the edge in a day.
Yeah.
No writing resolution. Mysteries with no mystery box. In a weird way, it's kind of suggesting the future of Star Trek writing under J.J. Abrams, where he says, I don't know, and you shouldn't know either.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't call it a mystery box. I think they're pretty overt as to what they're doing. But not getting to the edge of the galaxy, I don't think that's it's a little silly. They actually only do that a couple other times, one of them in a movie and one of them in the animated series. So, it's something to later see. The animated series, a lot of people can't stand it. It's made for kids. I remember watching it when I was a kid, although my wife probably says I'm still a kid. It's a rough go for that show, but it's, you know, it's got some good stories, and you can also read the full books if you want, with Alan Dean Foster, the writer, making these 20-minute cartoons like into full novellas. But yeah, interesting. That's it. So okay. Anything else you want to hit on?
No, wait, hold on. One last thing. I wanted to create a new tradition, because each time, you know, I get you.
No singing from. No singing.
So let's have a toast and a song. Okay. Just like Picard. Okay. I'm just going to sing a little bit, and I'm going to see if you can finish it. Okay.
I'm not going to be able to sing sing on, my lads, because I won't know. But go ahead.
A British tar is a soaring soul, except three is a mountain bird.
Yes, that's, isn't that from Gilbert and Sullivan? That's in Gilbert and Sullivan, and they used it later in Star Trek Insurrection, home of the Sears Blah collection in colors.
We live forever. Let's do nothing creative.
That's exactly right. And also, it doesn't have copyright, so we can keep using it. You know, but, you know, there you go. Otherwise, you have to pay the Beastie Boys for the one song that they know. But anyway, I think that's pretty much everything that I would have to say about this. What about you, Mike?
I'm enjoying the journey.
All right, then.
We had technical difficulties in the beginning, and yet I realized, you know what? I was still waiting eagerly to chat with my good buddy Matt again about Star Trek. And I am thrilled that we'll be getting to DS9 by the time I'm, 50, and Matt's 85.
Ouch, thanks. Well,
he's 35 years older than me, gentlemen.
Yeah, no, I'm not. But anyway, I do appreciate the time we spent together, and I look forward to doing some more. It was a good time. And I look forward to seeing our next episode. And for all of you out there, I hope you're enjoying the journey so far. And as always, like, share, and subscribe. And join us next time on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies. Live long and prosper, Mike.
Live long and prosper as well, sir.
All right, take care. Dear friend. All right, bye-bye.
Have a good night.
See ya.